Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA, is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hi, I'm Paul Lewis, and I'm here with my partner on this presentation, Sean Liu. I'm an of counsel at DLA Piper. Sean, are you off mute?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Just letting Paul do the intros, but I will be talking to all of you in the second half of the presentation.
Great. So for today's agenda, we're going to start with a quick refresher on diversity jurisdiction and removal for some important background. I'm going to move through those slides a bit more quickly than the rest. Then we're going to hit one of the two primary topics for today's webinar, which is the certification of the salient dispositive questions from federal courts to state Supreme Courts. And even though this is generally applicable to the vast majority of federal courts, the vast majority of states, we'll be focusing on First Circuit, DMAS, SJC, Mass Courts, et cetera, given that this is a BBA webinar. And then Sean's going to take over and discuss how to establish complete diversity when closely held companies such as LLCs are parties to the litigation. So to kick it off, first topic, removal. Governing removal are some federal statutes, as well as the rules of civil procedure, as well as DMAS local rules. For that reason, when you're going to remove a case, it's important that you consult all of those sources. The types of civil actions that can be removed are those that are originally brought by the plaintiff, of course, in a state court, but which nevertheless include certain aspects that would theoretically give a federal court original jurisdiction of the actions. So what does original jurisdiction mean? There's several different kinds, but we're going to focus on the two that are by far the most common. The first is diversity jurisdiction. In normal diversity jurisdiction or ordinary diversity jurisdiction, the amount of controversy has to exceed $75,000, and there has to be complete diversity. Complete diversity means that no plaintiff and defendant are residents of the same state, and Sean's presentation is going to hit on that, what that exactly means in a little bit more detail in about half an hour. And then under the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, or CAFA, where there are more than $5 million at stake and at least one plaintiff is a resident of at least one state that is different from that of at least one defendant, one could remove under CAFA. So that's sort of relaxed diversity jurisdiction. As to federal questions, under both the Constitution and federal statute 28 U.S.C. 1331, the lawsuit, and more specifically, at least one of the claims in the lawsuit, has to arise under federal law. As an important note, merely having a defense under, say, the Constitution or federal law does not in and of itself confer federal question jurisdiction. And additionally, if the lawsuit brings federal claims, or at least one federal claim, as well as state law claims, then the federal court will exercise supplemental jurisdiction over those state law claims so that everything can be heard in one forum and in one case. So the procedure for removing an action from state court to federal court under 28 U.S.C. 1446 is to file, these are usually one page, two pages, three pages, just a short and plain statement of the grounds for removal. It's almost like a complaint, but even far more pared down than a complaint. It just, the top of it looks like this. The contents of the notice of removal include very short paragraphs, one to two sentence, kind of numbered paragraphs about procedural background. You assert that the removal is timely, and I'll get to that, what that means in a second. You assert that you've met the prerequisites for federal jurisdiction under whatever your applicable theory of original federal jurisdiction is, be it, you know, diversity with its couple different prerequisites or federal question jurisdiction. You assert that you've removed to the proper venue and how you know it's the proper venue. You state your intention to also inform the state court in a moment, and I'll get to that. And then it's best practice to also reserve your rights to litigate on any grounds, or in other words, make it so the contents of the notice of removal don't bind you in any way for the subsequent federal litigation. Getting to the amount in controversy itself, generally and by default, this is the sum demanded in the initial pleading. That's usually the amount in controversy. There are, of course, scenarios where the removing party, the defendant, can assert, for example, that the amount in controversy is more than $75,000 if they really, really want to be in federal court. Whereas if the plaintiff wants to fight that through a motion to remand, they can assert that it's under $75,000. And in sum, so the notice of removal itself only really needs to include a plausible allegation that the amount in controversy exceeds the jurisdictional threshold. The time to get into specifics, if ever, and usually not, but if ever, would usually be when litigating a motion to remand by the plaintiff. And that is where there might even be an evidentiary hearing or some sort of evidence as to, you know, what's plausible. Is it plausible that this is going to be above $75,000, or is that not plausible? The removal package itself includes copies of process pleadings and other things from the defendant, from the lower court's file. Obviously, the removing party needs to pay the court filing fee and then also file the other papers, the cover sheets, et cetera, that would need to be filed when opening a federal case in the first instance. The next step is to file with the state court a notice of removal to basically tell the state court that, at least for the time being and perhaps permanently, it's divested of jurisdiction. This also serves as a notice to the state court of its obligation to directly send the contents of a certified contents of its entire record directly to the federal court. Of course, you want to serve all parties with everything that you're filing either in state court or federal court. As to deadlines for removal, you want to file the notice of removal within 30 days. Now, that's 30 days of either when you're served with the initial complaint, or if something happens in the lawsuit that either gives you notice that removal is now possible, i.e. that there is now federal original jurisdiction, or if you're served with some sort of paper or get some sort of evidence that indicates the same, then it's 30 days from that point. And that's 28 U.S.C. 1446. If the defendants are served at later, at different times, removal basis is right in the complaint, then it is the time frame from the latest served defendant. So in that scenario, the earlier served defendant could have a little bit more time. In ordinary diversity cases, does not apply to CAFA, but in ordinary diversity cases, no matter what happens, a case cannot be removed more than 1 year after filing. I said no matter what, but the one exception is if there's really some bad faith found, like it comes out in the lawsuit later after 1 year into the lawsuit that the plaintiff was taking certain steps or doing something else unethical to prevent the defendant from learning they could remove or prevent the case from being removable. After 28 days of filing the notice of removal, all certified copies of all documents within the state court's file have to land in the federal court under our local rules. Now, belt and suspenders best practices, in my opinion, is once you do the notice of removal, within a couple days, it's best practice to go get those certified documents from the state court and actually file them in a separate ECF entry. Technically, the state court is supposed to do this, and they're supposed to do it in a timely fashion well within this 28 days, but not all state courts do, and I've actually had one situation where they didn't. So in theory, or at least arguably, your basis would be covered If a state court doesn't do what it's supposed to do, provided that within 28 days, you yourself have put those on file via ECF in the federal court. As to deadlines for responding to complaint following the removal, it's either 21 days after being served or 7 days after the notice of removal is filed. If you've already filed your response of pleading, you don't have to do that again. If you've already gotten action on a motion to extend the deadline for responding to responsive pleading, or sorry, for filing a responsive pleading, be it an answer, motion to dismiss, whatever, and that's already on the state court docket, you don't need the federal court to act on that again. If you filed such a thing, but it hasn't been acted on by the state court, I think best practice is to immediately file it again in federal court, because even though the federal court should theoretically act on it, it won't appear as a new ECF entry. So, you know, you're concerned about time, your time to respond to the pleading is running out. You probably want to get the federal court's attention on that as soon as possible. All right. Now moving to one of the two primary topics here, question certification. So before we get into what it is and how to do it, it's important to get slightly more background on diversity jurisdiction. Such as why we have diversity jurisdiction. So back in the day when relationships between states and state governments, perhaps citizens of states, may have been considerably more contentious, especially certain states relative to other certain states, there was a concern that an out-of-state litigant might have some inherent bias against him by a given state's judiciary. So the goal was to subject litigants to the applicable law, still the applicable law of the relevant state, but it's in a neutral forum, the neutral forum being the federal courts, which the theory went would have less bias in favor of the resident of their state relative to the state court itself. The law applicable when you're in diversity jurisdiction substantively is state law. Federal courts need to apply established state law to adjudicate disputes that are grounded in state law. Significantly, federal courts are not supposed to make new law for the state, because that is a job left to the states. To get a little more into the weeds, we all remember the Erie Doctrine. It is state substantive law that the federal courts are supposed to apply when they're in diversity jurisdiction. By contrast, they're supposed to apply federal procedural law. That's, you know, the federal rules of civil procedure first and foremost, but then there's a number of other sort of doctrines and areas of law that qualify as procedural when there's an Erie analysis, but that's a presentation for another day. It's also interesting, the prior to Erie, which was from in 1938, it was only the state statutes that were supposed to be applied rather than sort of the way that a state's common law doctrines have been developed, which got messy. So what Erie effectively did is it put way more stuff in the category of state substantive law that needs to be applied by federal courts when those federal courts are sitting in diversity jurisdiction. So here we get to the topic at hand. What happens when the state, applicable state law is unclear or doesn't exist? When there's no controlling state court appellate precedent, that's important, we'll get into that more in a sec, that might provide compelling guidance on an issue, you certify the question, or at least that's where question certification might potentially come into play if other prerequisites are met. So in essence, question certification is where when federal courts certify a legal question, they ask the highest appellate court of the state whose law is at issue to answer that question. Geographically, it doesn't really matter, right? Like if for some reason DMAS is applying New York law under a contract or whatever, DMAS has just as much authority to certify something to New York's top court as it does to Massachusetts's top court. So this can be done either sua sponte or by motion. When litigants ask federal courts to certify a legal question by motion, they move the federal court for relief, and the relief is in the form of question certification, but then it still takes, obviously, the step of the federal court to actually effectuate the question certification if and when it allows the motion. So why does question certification exist? As I previewed a little while ago, it effectively fills a hole that was left by the very notion, the very concept of diversity jurisdiction, and more specifically, the fact that even when courts are sitting in diversity jurisdiction, they are not supposed to make new state substantive law. Indeed, they respect states' rights to create their own law. This is what kind of comes together in a cooperative judicial federalism. It's also been posited by the Supreme Court that even though it's an additional massive step in the case itself, in the long run, it saves resources because you don't have federal courts, be it at the trial level or the appellate level, and potential state appellate courts both dealing with potentially the same issue. You just have the state top appellate court dealing with it, and then the issue is done. Then it gets decided. So in Massachusetts, which again is where I said we were going to focus, so question certification, it is available in most states. Typically, this is via state statute. It's not all states. I think there are about five states where it's not available. And in those states, if it's those states' law that's at issue, it's not an option. There's no way to get around it. Typically, in those scenarios, the court sitting in diversity jurisdiction will either just have to take its best guess, maybe based on some sort of persuasive authority, or the lack of a question certification protocol for the relevant state might give rise to a federal court's decision to abstain from hearing the case. But again, that's a question for a different, but abstention is an issue for a different presentation. So in Massachusetts, it's not by state statute. Massachusetts SJC Rule 103 governs question certification here. And one more time, just to be clear, that's if any federal court anywhere, trial level or appellate level, including the United States Supreme Court, is looking at substantive Massachusetts law, they all have equal right to, through Rule 103, to certify the salient question. And Rule 103 started in 1971. How often are questions certified to the SJC? A former SJC justice opined on this. It's usually not more than a handful, and at least most years there is a certified question. So how do you do it? As I mentioned earlier, a party can move for question certification or, and I actually saw this at the First Circuit last year, the First Circuit could just say, hey, I think this is a good situation for question certification. And it doesn't need the parties to weigh in or opine or take a position or assent or anything. The First Circuit or the U.S. District Court can just do it. So that's when they would just do it sua sponte. Maybe they ask the courts to brief their opinions, but again, there's no technical requirement that even one party agrees to question certification. There is a ton of discretion as to whether to certify, and in particular, when a question certification decision is made. I'm not aware of any case law where the First Circuit looks at DMAS's decision to certify a question and says they shouldn't have done that. That's reversible. I mean, in theory, maybe it could happen, but I don't even really see how. I think it's extremely unlikely. What you'll see more often is DMAS not certifying a question, and then however it comes out, being appealed to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit saying, hey, this question should have been certified. We're going to certify the question now. If you are the litigant, if you're the party who wants the question certified for whatever reason, it is definitely best practice to make that request in DMAS. To be clear, this isn't a hard preservation the way that other issues might be preserved, but it is one factor that the First Circuit looks at in a situation where you as a litigant might want to be certifying that same question from the First Circuit. They'll look to whether you did it at the trial level and got denied. So it's sort of a soft preservation type of thing. The prerequisites and factors that are looked at of the question certification stem initially from SJC Rule 103. And then once you hit those prerequisites, there are there are other factors that are looked at so in sort of federal procedural common law. So first, those prerequisites under 103 are that there are no, this is a, the quote says, no controlling precedent in the decisions of this court. Now, since it's an SJC rule, it sounds like they're referring directly to the SJC. However, at least one on-point Massachusetts appeals court decision that, you know, goes directly to the issue will typically negate the question cert. This is becomes even more likely, already very likely, but it becomes even more likely where there are no dissents and where further appellate review is denied. I think there would be an interesting argument if it was one of those 128 or rule, and now it's rule 23 mass appeals court decisions where it's like not fully published, not fully for precedent, but it goes directly to the issue. I think there'd be good arguments on both sides of that. I haven't seen that litigated. So significantly, however, if the appeals court or even the SJC treats the issue kind of in a cursory way, maybe a light dicta treatment, it's not directly the thing being litigated. The reasoning that goes to the issue in your case isn't exactly the reasoning that was needed to come to the determination. The issue in that case, that will not negate question cert. That does not constitute controlling precedent for the purposes of question cert. And also, trial level decisions, even fully published superior court decisions, do not themselves negate question cert. Maybe there's an argument if there's a bunch of them and they're all published and long and well-reasoned that the state law on that is clear. But I think the argument going the other way, if you're arguing about question cert in the federal court, would be stronger. Question obviously must be one of Massachusetts law in order to certify it to the SJC, and it must be dispositive. And in this context, dispositive means that, let's say there are two possibilities, two realistic possibilities of how the potential question might be answered. If one of the possibilities would then go back to the U.S. District Court and effectively end the case for whatever reason, let's say it's like a statute of limitations, statutory interpretation type question, then that makes it dispositive. And obviously, and the alternative, if the answer is no, then, you know, you can keep going and keep litigating the case, but it's still dispositive if just one direction of the answer to the certified question would effectively end the case. So in the First Circuit DMAS, they've said that the SJC Rule 103 factors in and of themselves are not enough. So in effect, they're treated as prerequisites, but First Circuit and DMAS have sort of raised the bar. They consider additional factors in sort of a balancing type of discretionary test. So these are, once again, not hard prerequisites, but typically you'll need at least a strong showing on one of these in order to actually get the case certified in the First Circuit and DMAS. They look at the overall impact, the answer to the question. I mean, is this a crazy unique circumstance that's going to effectively, you know, most likely be limited to the facts of the case? Or does the salient, call it a statutory interpretation question, is that going to affect a lot of people? If it's going to affect a ton of people going forward, then the federal court will be even more reticent to answer that question. They look at whether state policy level policy interests must be examined. As with abstention decisions, federal courts are always extremely reticent to dig into state policy, and also the extent to which key facts might remain in dispute. The best practice, if you want the question certified, is to frame it up in a way that has obviously the fewest disputed facts necessary to be put forth by way of background in order to actually get the question answered. And if that means you have to wait a little bit into the litigation, a little bit more discovery, whatever, to get those kind of key facts dealt with, I think that is probably the best way to do it. You don't need to certify the question or move to certify the question at any particular point. Most commonly, you'll see it at one of the big inflection points, motion to dismiss, class certification, summary judgment, but that's not a hard prerequisite at all. All right, so once you get it certified, what's next? The federal court puts forth a certification order with a question of law to be answered and puts forth relevant facts. Typically, that's primarily done through the actual, you know, federal court decision itself that decides the question certification is appropriate. And so they'll sign off on it, and then the parties brief and argue the issue before the SJC under the Massachusetts Rules of Appellate Procedure. For procedural purposes only, the plaintiff is treated as the appellant, but there's no discretion. It's looked at sort of tantamount to de novo review. They're not weighing what anyone says or how anyone's opined. They're looking at it very, very evenly. Once the SJC decides, sends it back to the U.S. District Court, that decision is binding on the U.S. District Court. I want to quickly go over a case study so we see this in action. This is a case that I litigated. It's Richardson versus the UPS store. It started off as a putative class action in the Essex County Superior Court, alleging that Mass General Laws Chapter 93A class was aggrieved by the UPS store's systematic overcharging in violation of state statute for all notary services. Statutory basis, you can see this sort of rarely used statute, an excerpt from it at the bottom there, 262 section 41. The emphasis at the bottom says the whole cost of noting, including recording and notices, shall in no case exceed $1.25. So the plaintiff's theory was that noting meant notarizing, in other words, anything that any notary service that the UPS store might do. And, you know, so then they're charging $10, $15, $20 for notary services, treble damages under 93A, 4-year statute of limitations, tons and tons of transactions. They were looking at back of napkin, some pretty substantial damages. They had support from their statutory interpretation, at least arguably, in a Massachusetts Superior Court decision. A set of FAQs from the Romney administration after they put forth an executive order relating to notary services, and a dissenting SJC opinion where the opinion as a whole pertained to a different issue. The UPS store did not have anything like that going its way. So the plaintiff won the motion to dismiss. The Essex Superior Court found the plaintiff's interpretation of the statute was potentially correct, that noting meant all notary services. So then the plaintiff filed a motion for class cert. Significantly, in that motion for class cert, for the first time, they asserted that one small facet of their damages, like when the notary signs, is worth more than $5 million. So all of a sudden, the CAFA bells are going off for UPS. UPS removes the case under CAFA because previously the case was not removable because the plaintiff sued the franchisee who was based in Massachusetts, UPS based in Atlanta, but it didn't matter. But now that more than $5 million are asserted, even though it's two years into the case, UPS could remove the case under CAFA because of the relaxed diversity jurisdiction requirements, because UPS was not a resident of Massachusetts. Plaintiffs moved to certify the class again. The UPS store opposed and also moved to certify the statutory interpretation question. What does the word noting mean? Does that mean all notarizations or not? To the SJC. In support of UPS's position, we had these notary manuals from 200 years ago that showed that the word noting, or at least suggested that the word noting didn't mean any notarizing. It actually meant the first step in a notarial protest, which we don't do anymore. But basically, someone would write a bad check. The person to whom the check was written would go to the bank. There's not enough money in the bank. The first step in prosecuting that and in any remedy for the person who received the bad check was to go to a notary. They don't really do these anymore, although there's processes are still on the books. And the first step in protesting that was sort of memorializing when the person came and what they said about the bad check. And that was called noting the protest. So we felt good about our position, but all the supporting anything persuasive, granted, but all of it went the other way. So the U.S. District Court denied the motion for class certification without prejudice and allowed the motion to certify the question to the SJC, essentially saying, well, tell us what Chapter 262, Section 41 means. And we made it clear, this goes to what I was saying about the disputed facts or lack thereof, through depositions that we'd previously taken, that nothing that the lead plaintiff was asserting or saying happened had anything to do with the protest. So the question that was certified to the SJC basically asked when the Notary Act at issue has nothing to do with the protest, does Section 41 or kind of 43 prevent the UPS or the notary from charging fees in excess of this $1.25 fee cap? Parties then briefed and argued the case at the SJC. The SJC, relying on our, I guess you call them primary sources from a couple hundred years ago, found that noting does in fact mean the first step of the protest, thereby overruling everything from Massachusetts that had any ever said anything else. So then they had a certified answer that resulted. They sent it back to the U.S. District Court. And once it got back to the U.S. District Court, it was clear that the plaintiff's case was pretty much sunk. So everyone just stipulated to a dismissal. But had they not done that, we could have gone through a motion for judgment on the pleadings under 12C, now using the SJC's binding answer to question certification, as well as the facts that were found in the context of the U.S. District Court's certification of the question to the SJC, which is something that was considered, but it just wasn't necessary. So I think, noting that it's just after 12:30, I'm going to reserve questions for the end and turn it over to my partner, Sean. So I'll stop sharing right now.
Okay, great. Thank you, Paul. That was a great presentation. Let's see if we can figure out how to switch over easily here. So I believe my screen should be sharing now, and I will start my slideshow. All good, Paul?
All good, go ahead.
All right, beautiful. Hi, everyone. I'm Sean Liu. I'm a shareholder here at Murphy & King, specializing in business and shareholder disputes. Today, we're talking about pitfalls for closely held companies. We're kind of mostly focusing on LLCs, but we'll talk a little bit about trusts as well. The way this is going to go is, especially since Paul did such a good job at setting up the basics, we're going to kind of zoom through those. But we will do a little bit of the basics on the different types of individuals slash entities that can be the parties at issue. We'll cover a few of the pitfalls, and then we'll see these pitfalls in action in the course of a case study. And we'll end with just some practice tips of how to address some of these issues. All right. So as we said, two primary sources, right, for subject matter jurisdiction. Today, we're focusing on just basic diversity jurisdiction. As we know, there's two requirements. One is the damages at issue should exceed $75,000, usually pretty easy to establish. And then the more tricky issue is complete diversity, right? As Paul said, no plaintiff may share a state of citizenship with any defendant. And diversity is determined at the time the action is brought. So there's a great body of case law that addresses shenanigans where people try to move after the action has already started, but you can't do that. You can't do that to either establish jurisdiction or to try to destroy existing jurisdiction. The burden, right? It's the standard is preponderance of the evidence. The burden is on the party seeking to invoke the federal jurisdiction. So that usually means, right, the plaintiff, if the plaintiff is the one bringing the case in federal court, or the removing party. Now let's talk about some of the possible parties and the types of parties we can have. Individuals, obviously, is the most easy to deal with. So natural persons, right, which is what an individual is, are simply citizens of the state in which they are domiciled, right? So of course, what does domiciled mean? I've always thought it's never precise, but the court's technical definition is two things. One is physical presence in a place, and second, the intent to make that place one's home. So as you all know, usually it is the intent that the court has to struggle with figuring out. So courts typically take into account a variety of factors. I mean, these are all pretty obvious factors, right? You're taking into account, frankly, more than anything else, if there's a permanent residence. Now, courts are always careful to say permanent residence alone is not dispositive, but they also typically say more often than not it is, right? So you look at all of the things that go with, where somebody permanently resides. That usually includes place of employment, where your, driver's license is from, automobile registration, payment of taxes, voting, all of the real property, bank accounts, memberships, the things that you would exactly expect to see. So usually not a huge debate about individuals, but it can turn on that intent to place, or excuse me, the intent to make a place one's home. More interesting are corporations. So corporations is actually defined by statute, and it's always called a limited exception by Congress. As Paul kind of covered, you know, federal courts are really just courts of limited jurisdiction. So usually you need a reason, and it needs to be established for why you can be in federal court. So for corporations, it's the one type of entity that is actually provided for in statute. For a corporation, a citizen, it's a citizen of potentially two states, right? It is, excuse me, this a citizen of the state of incorporation, but also where it maintains a principal place of business. So, of course, you can have two different states for each of those, right? Or I should say two different states for those. But you can also have, obviously, the same state as the state of incorporation and where your principal place of business is, which is often the case. Congress, however, did not make a provision for the treatment of other artificial entities that are not corporations, which is, you know, what we're going to deal with next. But as everybody knows, corporations usually not that much of a debate of where they're a citizen. So now that takes us to non-corporate entities, right? That includes some of the things we will talk about today, which is LLCs and trusts. It also includes partnerships, but those are, you know, pretty simple to deal with for the reasons we'll discuss. So non-corporate legal entities, right, take the citizenship of all of their members, right, or partners. That means you basically have to go through what the courts are calling a iterative process, where a party basically has to trace through the various levels of membership, as we will see and discuss. An LLC, for example, right, has members, but those members can be individuals, they can be corporations, they can be trusts, they can be other LLCs. So you can see that this process can involve tracing many different levels. And there's no shortcut for this. You have to trace through as many levels as possible until you get to the very bottom. Just offering an extreme case, you know, this West versus Louisville case involved basically 17 different layers of ownership of an LLC, and the court went through all of them. Now, there's surely fewer, and there's probably cases with more, but you can tell that even with 17, you can't discharge this duty and obligation, and we will see what happens when you try to. So looking specifically at limited liability companies, right? I truly believe that LLCs basically are the cause of most of the issues when it comes to questions about complete diversity, right? So as we all know, an LLC is kind of a hybrid structure that includes some of the best parts of a corporation, but adds in the flexibility of kind of like a partnership, right? It's its own unique animal. And as we said, members can include basically any number of other types of individuals and entities, right? And therein creates our problem. So I like to call the iterative process turtles all the way down. As an aside, that's a term that I try to incorporate into as many things as I can. I encourage everybody to look at the background of that particular terminology just for a fun read. But you get my gist. So you do have to trace it through every single layer, because any of those members and individual members of other LLCs down the line will still affect your complete diversity for the analysis, right? One interesting aside is where you have internal disputes, right, that involve the LLC itself. Where the LLC actually is a necessary party, it's pretty much impossible for you to establish complete diversity, because the LLC is going to be considered to have the same citizenship as the adverse member. So, you know, the only way to really do that is if you can establish that the LLC is not an indispensable party, and you just have basically LLC members suing each other. And of course, you still have to meet the complete diversity requirements. right? So let's also talk briefly about a trust, and we will see actually in the case study, you know, the interaction between LLCs as well as trusts. So trusts can also be pretty complicated because, let's generally speaking, you're dealing with two different kinds of trusts with very different rules when it comes to analyzing complete diversity. These things usually turn on basically whether legal title is taken by trustee for the benefit of others, or whether the trust itself is a separate legal entity with legal rights and a legal identity, right? And so these two types of trusts are what have been called by the courts traditional trusts and business trusts, right? Sometimes they change the name of these, but traditional trust is usually uniformly referred to as such. Traditional trust is, as everybody is familiar with, the background here is, you know, as usually they begin as fiduciary relationships, and the trusts themselves are not treated as distinct legal entities. Common example would be, you know, like a family trust where you have a grantor who delivers property to the trustee for the maintenance and welfare of a beneficiary, right? And, you know, plenty of case law describes those kinds of trusts. Importantly, if it's a traditional trust, that trust takes the citizenship of only the trustees, right? In other words, whatever the citizenship of the individuals, right? Humans must be trustees. So the individual humans, unless you're tracing through other layers, but the individual human citizenship will be transposed onto the trusts, right? For a traditional trust, you are not looking at the members and or the beneficiaries, right, who are essentially the members. That becomes very important in, every situation. So business trusts, right, on the other hand, courts will look at, sometimes, let's be real, it can be difficult to determine whether something is a traditional trust or business trust. But the courts will look at, you know, a number of factors, which usually turn on, can the entity be sued itself? And can it sue? And also, to what extent, other extents, right? Is it treated as basically the equivalent of a separate entity or individual under state law, right? As you may have guessed, the citizenship for the business type of trust, right, that has a separate legal existence, you do have to look at the citizenship of the members and beneficiaries, not unlike, right, what you would do for basically an LLC, right? And this distinction can be very important, as we will see. So just very quickly, some common pitfalls, which we will actually see in action and explore a little bit in the context of the case study. But here are some just common, I think, pitfalls that are important to bear in mind. So as everybody knows, if you're the plaintiff, right, or the removing party, as we said, the initial burden is on you to establish the basis for jurisdiction, which of course includes complete diversity, right? So you do need to do, and what the courts have called good faith, and then in my words, due diligence. And what that means is, I think you need to look at what publicly available information there is, okay? And we will talk about this because obviously for a person bringing the case in the beginning, right, the plaintiff may not have access to information that is not public regarding the various entity-type defendants' internal membership, right? And we'll talk about that issue and how to deal with it. So obviously you need to first do due diligence to do the best you can and allege at least what you can determine. And you do need to allege that there is the existence, right, of complete diversity. There are, as of a recent amendment at the end that took effect at the end of last year, we'll talk about that. But the rule now requires parties early on to disclose the various levels of membership, even for entities like an LLC. But we will talk about that after the case study, because it offers, I think, a very different landscape now for how we can deal with some of these issues. Of course, the most common problem is parties treating, and this can be both parties, treating non-corporate entities as if they were corporations, right? As we know, corporations take citizenship from the place of incorporation and principal place of business, but that does not apply, right, to LLCs. But you will see people do so and continue to make that mistake. Now, One good tool to have is you can actually, after a case has started, it frequently occurs where people discover that the parties discover that maybe one party, right, would destroy that complete diversity, especially once you start diving down, right, into the various LLC levels. If that does happen, what you can do is dismiss the one party, presuming that it is an easy, right, clean break. You can dismiss the one party that would destroy complete diversity, and the courts have been pretty willing to allow you to do that. And then you can keep the case, continue operating in the same jurisdiction that you're in. Now, where a trust is at issue, as we mentioned, there's a big difference, right, between the different kinds of trusts. So the one thing you need to make sure you are doing, if you, the burden is on you, is at least alleging enough facts to establish what the nature, right, of the trust is, so that the court knows which type of analysis am I doing? Am I looking at the citizenship of the trustees or the members, right? And we will see that play out as well in the case study. And then lastly, this is important too, right? You cannot actually establish subject matter jurisdiction, right? Meaning diversity here, by agreement, right? Consent or waiver. So what this means is there can always be reasons, right, why a defendant LLC may not want to reveal its members. But that's not a choice you have. So even if you were in a situation where a plaintiff and a defendant agree, let's just not get into it. All right. Like, we will waive, whether you call it a waiver, whether you call it a consent. But even if the parties agree, let's not go any further. We just agree there is complete diversity. That's not good enough. Okay. That's not good enough for the court. And it can create a lot of problems, right? There is by now, especially with the case study that we will now be looking at, plenty of case law that tells you that you cannot waive or agree to complete diversity. The court is still going to look at it and make sure you never do that.
Before you get into the case study, I think you have a couple hypotheticals.
Do you
see them? In the question and answer.
Oh.
At the bottom of your screen.
Well, let's perhaps address those at the end. Thank you, Paul. I just want to make sure that we do have time to get through this. And then if we do have time for questions and hypotheticals, we are happy to address them. All right. So we just covered common pitfalls, and let's take a look at the case study. So here, I kind of take this case as the case that had everything. All right. Very recent case that went up to the First Circuit. The case was called BRT, right, versus Malden Storage. It was filed in January 2017, and it was heard by Judge Saylor, right? So here you have the plaintiff is BRT. You have three different LLC defendants. We will talk about them as necessary, but you can see my abbreviations there. And then the defendants also brought counterclaims, which become important. They also actually brought a claim against a third-party counterclaim defendant, but that's not really relevant for our current diversity analysis, so we won't be talking about that. So let's just keep in mind the plaintiff and the three LLC defendants. So given that the plaintiff filed this case in the district court itself, it did bear the initial burden, right, to allege the basis for diversity. The defendants, of course, filing counterclaims also had to include allegations about diversity. What happened in this case is, frankly, both sides treated the LLC entities as, at least in their allegations, as if they were corporations, right? You see allegations where people, where both sides were alleging the usual place of business, i.e. the primary place of business, as well as where the entities were incorporated, and they did not allege any further facts with respect to the memberships of those LLCs in the first instance. So this did not escape Judge Saylor, who actually writes frequently about jurisdictional issues. And he ordered a show cause, mostly directed at the plaintiff for, why shouldn't we dismiss this case, given that you haven't alleged sufficient facts to establish that complete diversity? So the plaintiff did try to beef up the information based on additional allegations and additional affidavits. There, they at least completed the analysis for plaintiff itself, right? BRT, the LLC, had a sole member that was a natural person. That person was domiciled in Massachusetts, and nice and easy, right? So BRT was a Massachusetts citizen, right? So plaintiff is done. Now, with respect to the defendant LLCs, however, Both Malden and Plain Avenue, okay, had the same single or sole member, which is an entity called C Banner Storage LLC, right? But that, as we know, because it's an LLC, there needed to be further analysis, and the plaintiff did not provide that with respect to Banner Drive, right? The other defendant, Banner Drive LLC, the plaintiff did establish that there was another LLC that was the sole member, Banner Storage. However, the analysis, again, did not continue beyond that. So as you may have guessed, Judge Saylor, this did not escape Judge Saylor's notice. He issued a second show cause order, basically requiring, right, the further extrapolation of those LLCs. At this point, the plaintiff realized, all right, I really don't have access to that information to trace it that far, and it requested limited discovery, right, which Judge Saylor readily granted. Right. And we'll talk about requesting limited discovery later. With respect to the discovery that did happen, somewhere along the line, the plaintiffs and the defendants, for whatever reasons, some obvious, some perhaps not as obvious, didn't want to continue the exercise, right, which to them seemed pretty laborious, especially once they realized that one of the defendants, right, Banner Drive, as we previously mentioned, one of the defendants actually had more than 80 members through various or many levels. And one of those members actually was a Massachusetts resident. So, as we know, that alone risked blowing up the case and destroying complete diversity. So the parties actually decided, you know what, we're all fine with dismissing Banner Drive, the defendant Banner Drive, out of this case and maintain diversity. So that's what they apparently tried to do. But with respect to defendants Malden and Plain Avenue, they traced it one further level, right? So now they established that the sole member of C Banner, where they stopped last time, was another LLC called B Dev Manager. However, they did not further analyze beyond B Dev Manager, as we know that you're supposed to do. Let's see how that plays out. Anyway, they did agree, right? And this is their attempt to stop this exercise. They agreed amongst themselves that, look, there is complete diversity and we are either consenting or waiver any further argument that there isn't. The court held a conference with the parties. The court agreed to dismiss, right? And entered an order dismissing Banner Drive and then allowed the litigation to proceed. But that means that this analysis with respect to both defendants Malden and Plain Avenue never actually completed because we stopped the ball at BDev Manager LLC, right? So just to tell you what happened in the rest of the case, and here's the roadmap. The case was filed in January of 2017. Took 4 years before the 9-day bench trial occurred in 2021. A final judgment was actually entered in the defendant's favor for their counterclaims. So they were now holding a judgment against the plaintiff. I'm going to keep calling them the defendants just for the sake of just keeping the stuff straight. But they were now holding a judgment in excess of $10 million against the plaintiff as of February 2022. And then the plaintiff naturally appealed to the First Circuit in May of 2022. So the First Circuit, as we previously discussed, readily recognized that, look, you guys cannot stipulate to the existence of complete diversity. It doesn't matter that you don't want to do the exercise or that you are happy to waive diversity. It can't be consented away. And so the First Circuit essentially forced the parties to further address the deficiencies where they left off. And given that the record was insufficient, right, based on where we stopped with BDev LLC, the First Circuit ordered the parties to submit affidavits even at the appellate level of jurisdictional facts. The parties did so in several rounds of affidavits. Interestingly enough, now, because the defendants, right, Malden and Plain Avenue, were the ones that were holding the massive judgment in their favor, they now had the vested interest in establishing complete diversity, right? The plaintiff, original plaintiff, right, BRT, suddenly realized, maybe I don't want complete diversity here in order to vacate that original judgment against them. So now you see Malden and Plain Avenue file several affidavits tracing their members through all of the various levels. However, the First Circuit considered their efforts also at this level insufficient. The First Circuit did in fact vacate the judgment and remanded it to the district court so that the parties could have one, frankly, the defendants could have one final opportunity to establish complete diversity. Now, to be frank, the First Circuit was not thrilled with how this case had progressed or the parties' various efforts to establish complete diversity, or I should say not have sufficient information to establish complete diversity. And the First Circuit took issue with the fact that the final version of the affidavit still did not describe the nature of certain trusts, right? In order for it to be able to determine, are we looking at the citizenship of the trustees or the members, right? And we discussed that previously about trusts. Interestingly, the First Circuit also ended its decision with a coda, which basically just provided guidance to, I guess, everyone, saying, okay, we understand the difficulty a plaintiff initially faces, right, without access to information. And it did sign off on the district court's sensible approach on allowing jurisdictional discovery. Just to finish the story off, on remand, the parties yet again submitted affidavits. This time, Malden and Plain Avenue did submit sufficient information. It turned into a debate actually about two specific trusts, and it turned on whether the court agreed that they were traditional trusts rather than business trusts. And the reason for that is because there was a beneficiary somewhere down the road of one of those trusts, or actually two trusts, shared a beneficiary residing in Massachusetts, which could have destroyed complete diversity if it had been determined to be a business trust. Instead, Judge Saylor agreed that it was those trusts were traditional trusts, and because you had an Illinois trustee, we did maintain complete diversity in that case. So Judge Saylor entered a order at the end of last year confirming jurisdiction and re-entering the judgment, the original judgment, and returned it to the First Circuit for further proceedings, right? At this point, I just want to mention, in the course of that pending appeal, the Rule 7.1 was amended, right? And it became effective in December 1st, 2022, right? So this was actually right in the period before the First Circuit entered that BRT opinion. Now, what it does is everybody knows this in the context of the first requirement under Rule 7.1 is for corporate parties, right, to identify parent corporations, as well as any publicly held corporation that owns more than 10% of its stock. What the amendment did is add a new requirement that every party, right, not just corporations, now must file a disclosure statement identifying essentially the various levels, right, of citizenship for any entities that have members, right? Here's the text for you. I don't need to read it for you, but that is the gist of what you are now required to do as of that effective date, right? And the timing of this is important because you are supposed to file these disclosures basically with your first appearance or filing, right? And so I think the reasons for this amendment were obvious. This is trying to at least make it easier for courts as well as the parties to determine, you know, is there a problem with complete diversity early on in the case, right? Preferably not 4 years later or after trial, even at that, right? And so it also is intended to help a little bit with the catch-22 where, you know, the previous scheme, right, was basically a party just alleges, you know, whatever it can and then needs to request discovery. But the catch-22 is discovery usually is not allowed unless you have some basis, right, for needing it. So this forces the disclosure to happen, particularly with respect to defendants, very early on in the case, right? And that would also give you more information potentially to require further discovery. And more interestingly, I think, is it creates, right, this informal database, because if anybody has in the past, right, filed a disclosure for an LLC, that's there forever, right? It becomes a public record. And one thing that you could do, which we'll talk about, is you can actually look up, right, when you're about to sue somebody in federal court or remove to federal court, why not? Take a look at PACER, and you've got a bunch of different tools that you can use to search it. Why not take a look at, has this party been sued in federal court and has it filed a Rule 7.1 disclosure? And then it gives you a lot of the information about, you know, what the memberships are and what the citizenships are. Perhaps it will eventually be part of the required due diligence that a plaintiff maybe should or could do in order to establish their jurisdiction to begin with. So takeaways and practice tips, right? As we've learned from BRT and similar cases, we know that complete diversity cannot be established, right? You can't just agree with the other side that we have it, right? It's not going to be good enough for the court. And I can tell you the First Circuit will not be okay with it. They'll look at the issue anyway, and they will probably severely shame you for trying to do that. With regard to PACER databases, we just mentioned, now that you have this Rule 7.1 disclosure requirement, right, still pretty new, but it may become the standard that you will actually be required to look at it. I don't think that's happened yet, but when the courts are deciding, right, the next item, when the courts are deciding, has the plaintiff or other party bearing the burden basically done everything it could do short of obtaining jurisdictional discovery, maybe that due diligence is going to include, have you reviewed the existence of 7.1 disclosures? And if not, then maybe that's going to be a grounds for not allowing you to do further jurisdictional discovery. We know that from the CODA, right, from the BRT First Circuit decision, that the First Circuit is saying it should be pretty easy, okay, or at least it should be continued to be allowed of the plaintiff's requests or the other party's requests for jurisdictional discovery. And so given that that's the case, you should make sure that you ask for it if you need it, right? Otherwise, it can and will be held against you. Jumping to the last bullet point here, you know, you got to take advantage of every opportunity. As a reference to the BRT remand, in fact, at that point, BRT was trying to destroy diversity, and all it did was just challenge the sufficiency of the defendant's filings rather than conducting jurisdictional discovery itself. The court made that failure a pretty big feature of its ultimate decision, saying there's just no reason not to accept the defendant's filings. But then lastly, as we've said, Rule 7.1 is here, it's real, and the courts are going to take it seriously. So if you do not take it seriously, the courts have said, we will dismiss the case, and they have done so. With that, brings us to the end. Thank you very much. Paul, I don't know if you want to see if we have some time to address some of our questions.
I mean, they're all for your topic. I'm here though. Can you see them?
Let's see if I can. Q&A. All right. Somebody has asked, if an LLC member is a green card holder in Massachusetts and citizen of Canada, do you have diversity from an LLC member who has a actually, maybe I'll just put this on the screen.
This is a law school exam.
I know, right? So everybody can have fun. Everybody can see the question on my screen. Can you?
I cannot.
Oh, you can't. All right. Well, basically, the question is, if an LLC member is a green card holder and the citizen of Canada, right, do you have diversity with basically just a Massachusetts citizen? Well, the issue is not I think the green card is not the issue here, right? We're not talking about citizenship, right, for the purposes of like U.S. national citizenship. We're talking about whether you are considered to be a citizen of a state. So I would say the green card holding itself is not even relevant to Massachusetts. You still have to look at that LLC's other contacts with Massachusetts. So this doesn't change anything with how you, you know, you. I guess the question asker has not told me what the other memberships are for the or the other members are for the LLC. And then if somebody is simply an LLC member, that doesn't mean anything. You're still looking at your own individual citizenship under a state if you are simply suing somebody. So unfortunately, I think I just need more information. The next question, the only other question, is if an LLC files with the IRS as a corporation, does this matter? Well, I think that That's a weird situation. I would think it depends on under the law whether it's an actual LLC or an actual corporation. I guess I'm not sure what it means by you can file with the IRS as a corporation unless you just mean, you know, kind of like an S corp type of situation. But there it turns on whether it legally is an LLC or a corporation. The tax treatment is not dispositive in and of itself. So I think if you're registering as an LLC or you're registering as a corporation, I would say that is the deciding factor. Particularly if you're registered as a corporation, we know, you know, you do the place of registration as well as the principal place of business.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.